so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, another week. Another toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. I probably should sound more excited about this. I didn't really mean it. Like, here we go.
Oh,
another
boy.
One of these.
Another terrible week. alternatively, new week, same toy department.
Yeah, that works. How has your time been since we last spoke, Matt Kolsky?
Pretty good. I took a little jaunt down to old Los Angeles.
Oh, you did?
Past weekend, yeah. You know, just have some fun, see some friends, sort of a trip. And I've watched a couple of lackluster, I guess, NBA Finals games. And what else? That more or less covers it.
You know what? We didn't talk about this at all in our little pre-pod discussion. But
our producer meeting?
Yeah. Can I take issue with with the Los Angeles observation you made on the Twitters this weekend?
Potentially. I don't know why not.
All right. So, you know, I saw this tweet that you had about a-hole drivers, like a particular breed of a-hole driver.
Yeah. I really think L.A. is the worst.
I would like to take exception to that.
Really?
I would. Yeah. Just as a former Angelino.
Okay. Well, look, I've never seen you drive, just for the record.
Yeah, I'm very good. Look, the Los Angeles,
I'm an excellent driver.
The Los Angeles traffic experience, of course, is a nightmarish hellscape. I mean, that is what it is. But I was just in New York City the last couple of days, and
okay,
if you're just
that's a different sort of
if
bad.
You're just talking about sheer foolishness. And
no.
Orneriness and cutting people off and the constant horn. Like, there's only one universe in which the driver reigns supreme, and that is the tri-state area.
Yeah.
It's not close, I don't think.
I don't know offhand what my exact wording was on the tweet you're referring to, but I would not dispute your assertion that the New York driver is an angrier, more a-hole-ishy driver. It's that the LA driver is kind of the opposite. They're slow and stupid, and when they do speed up, they tend to do things like wildly change lanes without signaling. It's just like, and the result, you know, New York drivers, there's tons of cars, people are honking at each other, but everyone's kind of moving. The thing with LA is all the dumb things people do in LA seem to slow you down. So it's the thing about LA is that any traffic, I think this was the main gist of my tweet, any traffic situation you get in is three times as bad in LA as almost anywhere else you could be involved in that same situation.
Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, I didn't find it as someone who lived in the Bay Area for a long time. And honestly, I drew probably more in the Bay Area than I did in LA, which is, I know, weird. But I didn't find much of a difference.
Yeah, it's subtle. The Bay Area drivers are bad, too.
Yeah, they are. And I'm going to pivot from this.
It's like the whole state of California never had driver's ed. It really is.
Yeah, there is maybe something to that, and I'm going to pivot before I say something really horrendous.
Okay.
and
safety first.
Yeah, safety first. Safety first. I'm safety first. I'm going to wildly swerve lanes and talk about my weekend, because I did, as I mentioned, go to New York City.
Look at us, a couple of traveling guys.
That's right. That's right. I came to town for the governor's ball, which is great.
That is, by the way, when you texted me this at first, and I don't know if this is hopefully more reflective of me than you, I was like, governor's ball? Isn't that like a big fancy event in New York? He must mean some other thing in Minnesota.
You are not the first person to be like, so did you have to bring a tuxedo? And I was like, no, it's a music festival.
Yeah, it's not actually like a ball hosted at the governor's mansion, as it turns out.
Yeah, as it turns out. Because the governor of New York could be sitting across from me, and I don't think I would recognize him by sight. So, but no, it was a 3-day rock festival, which turned into a 2-day rock festival, as you may have heard that.
Yeah,
because day three got rained out.
How does that happen?
It rains really hard.
Shouldn't they be prepared for that eventuality in like late May, early June in New York? Shouldn't there be like an alternative so it doesn't just get entirely canceled when it rains?
I mean, what would the alternative be? Like an alternative place that you would have it indoors or something?
I don't know.
If you have lightning, you know what I mean?
Wet, just protect the equipment.
They did that for a while. That's part of the problem. Like, you know, it started raining pretty hard late day two. You know, you're in a grass field. If it rains for 24 straight hours, you know, that field's pretty torn up. And if there's lightning and you can't just move Kanye West's stage set up somewhere as we sort of found out.
Thunderstorms, I guess. I forget about how thunderstorms are different than just like the piddly rain we
get. Yeah, because we don't really have that thunder and lightning situation on the West Coast. So, but there was some of that on the East Coast. And so it was interesting because, you know, it was actually kind of one of those festivals where, look, whatever day Kanye was on was going to tower over the rest of this festival. The Strokes were the big headliner on Friday. The Killers were the big headliner on Saturday. But just to give you an idea, there was you go to the festival. You've been to a festival merch tent, right? Where it's like, hey, here's the merch, and there's a section for the festival merch. And then there's the section for all the band's merch.
Right.
This festival had the festival merch section, the band merch section, and then the Kanye merch section. And the Kanye merch section line was the longest. This was on a day that, you know, Kanye didn't play because at that point none of us knew that he wasn't going to be there tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, you know, the specter of Kanye towered over all. And then so we had this really sort of interesting situation on Sunday with the show being rained out, where people were trying to kind of put together these impromptu shows around New York City so you could kind of do a little bit of a Where's Waldo chase. So we wound up going over to Brooklyn where within a few blocks of each other, Courtney Barnett was doing a free show at Rough Trade. Two Door Cinema Club is at the Williamsburg Music Hall. The Prophets of Rage, who were supposed to do a surprise set, were playing a couple blocks down from that.
Oh, did you see them?
I did not see them.
No. I so want to see them.
And I would have liked to. And that was one of, to me, probably the biggest bummer was thinking that I was going to get a set from them in the evening and then not being able to make it to a third set. I think Vic Mensa did something somewhere, and then the big thing, you know, Kanye showed up at Summer Jam which got about half rained out. They mm-hmm. closed down the festival stage. Like Chance's set got canceled.
Ugh.
And then, you know, the big thing was he starts tweeting out like, "I'm going to play somewhere 2:00 in the morning in Manhattan."
I saw something about this.
Keep in mind, this is essentially Monday morning at 2 a.m.
Right.
The show turns out to be at Webster Hall, which seats about 1,500 people. About 5,000 people showed up for the line, which means there were riots in the streets. Essentially, I mean, riots is a strong word. There was a big crowd of people chanting.
Right. They were music fans making a ruckus.
Yes, making a ruckus. Yeah. They dented some, you know, car rooftops by standing on them and stuff like that. But, you know, it wasn't like burning down the Mission after the Warriors win. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you park on the streets in New York, you take your car's life into your hands.
Yeah. So people went nuts for that. And then Kanye, they wound up canceling that as well. So,
He never even played that.
No. It turned out.
I had heard some. That's the one thing I had like heard / read about was that Kanye was setting up this late night, but it never went off.
He showed up. And, you know, so people did see him there, but he did not actually
perform. They physically saw him. They did not see his music.
They did not see any of his music. So, Kanye all weekend, basically.
Yeah. You did see some bands, though?
I did see some bands, Friday and Saturday.
On Sunday. Did you catch anyone?
I went to see Two Door Cinema Club because I like them a lot and because they have a new record coming out. And I was hoping they were going to play some new stuff.
And did they?
And they played one new song, and it was good. It was actually a really good show. But there were, you know, there's always the opportunity cost with that kind of stuff because, like, you know, the problem is if like you could just wander into these things, and you know, being in the industry, I have some ability to do that. But you know, there's massive lines and everything, so you got to sort of got to pick and choose. You know what I mean? But it was fun to go to Brooklyn.
Did not catch Courtney Barnett.
I did not catch Courtney Barnett because I saw her about 3 weeks ago here. So
okay. Did we talk about that?
No.
Maybe put that on the list. I'd like to ask you about that.
Okay. Well, now's a good time.
Yeah, you want to just go right into Courtney Barnett?
Yeah, hit me.
Okay. So I got the album. Okay. Sometimes I sit and think, and sometimes I just sit, I believe is the title of her record.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it to be a really engaging, enjoyable indie rock record.
Mm-hmm.
And then I see people writing about it as if it's Meet the Beatles.
Well, look, I think it's an engaging and enjoyable indie rock record at a time in which those things are rare.
Okay, so you think that's all it is. It's not like I'm not missing something. So,
yeah, no, I wouldn't. I mean, I'm not downing Courtney Barnett at all because I think she made a really excellent record, and I think she's.
I just think it's a record that like fits inside the genre that she's in and is of that genre and not revolutionary or anything. I think it's good. It's really good.
I wouldn't say it's revolutionary. There are, you know what I mean? Like it has a little bit of like a. And I don't want to overblow this by, you know, making the comparison of like a Nirvana feel in that it's like it's indie rock, but it feels a little bigger than that, where it's maybe could be accessible to the sort of person that doesn't normally buy that kind of record. And I think it's a lyrically unique record. Like she has a really interesting lyrical viewpoint.
OK, that may be part of it then, because I'm just not a big lyrics guy.
Yeah. So, I think you'd at least pick up on, like, the lyrics to her songs are sort of different than
yes and no. Yes and no.
There's a lot of, you know, everyday observation. They're maybe a little bit more literal than some indie rock lyrics are, that kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah. I see what you mean.
Yeah, totally. So
that's all. I like her. I think she's really good. And by the way, one of my other favorite podcasts, Song Exploder. Are you aware of Song Exploder?
I'm aware of it, yeah.
I can't recommend it more, although maybe recommending other podcasts on your podcast isn't the best idea.
No, we're pro-recommending other people's podcasts because it gives us some cred when we crap on them later.
Yeah, no, I don't think we'll crap on Song Exploder. It's such a smart idea, and it's executed so very well. For people who don't know, basically the host, whose name is very difficult to pronounce, but I think it is Hrishikesh Hirway, he takes one song by an artist each episode. They're about 15 minutes long. And he interviews usually like one or two or three members of the band or, you know, a hip-hop artist and a producer or a solo artist and a producer about this one song. And they basically take it apart and tell you where the germ of the song came from, what the first notes were, you know, where did they get the hook or chorus or what have you. And then, like, how it all came together. And it just, if you like music, it varies from, you know, indie hip hop to pop to metal. I mean, it covers a lot of the bases. And it's just so interesting if you're a music lover to hear musicians take apart their work.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. And I pray it's one of those things where I'm always like, oh, I should check that out. But, you know, there's a lot of podcasts.
Yeah. No, there are. It's one, though, especially like, if you can keep an eye on it and make a point to listen when the artist or song is one that you're really interested in, I just think it's awesome.
Do you ever get podcast guilt where you realize that you enjoy listening to a podcast, but you know that there are certainly better podcasts that are probably better uses of your time?
Absolutely.
You know.
But never with Song Exploder.
Right, totally. I just wondered if that was a thing for you.
You know what, which one gets me the most of that now? And to the point where I struggle to enjoy it the way I once did is the Jay Moore podcast. I like Jay Moore. I think he's done just a lot of great podcasts. But man, sometimes I feel like it's just not a great use of my time when I have 10 WTFs backed up and, you know, honestly, the preponderance of basketball podcasts and the rate at which they're producing podcasts down the stretch of the season is a problem for me.
Yeah. No, there's a lot of if you're into sports, it's just one of those times where there's a lot of like time sensitive podcasts that you got to get through. And then, you know, so every time I find myself listening to a podcast that maybe talks about reality television, I'm like, what am I doing with my life? And yet there I am, still listening to it.
Is it? Do you even watch the reality television you're listening to people talk about?
Yeah, no, I watch. I only listen to podcasts about two specific reality shows, which are the two reality shows that I watch.
All right, spill.
The Challenge on MTV. And
now, is that like the vestige of the Real World Road Rules Challenge?
Yes.
But they just call it Challenge so they can put whoever they want in it now.
Yeah, well, they've been calling it the Challenge for a while because Road Rules disappeared, I don't know, God, 10 years ago probably now.
Right.
And they've since added people from a show called Are You the One, which I don't watch. I guess it's a dating show, apparently. And they're actually
Challenge is basically just like competing at random, like state fair events and stuff, right?
Well, yeah, sort of. They've made it, you know, like it's actually kind of a real athletic competition. There are definitely people who are taking steroids to be on the challenge. Because it's tough. Like, the stuff they have to do is pretty tough. It's not quite American Ninja Warrior tough, but, you know, it's in that same family of things.
Is American Ninja Warrior the other reality show that you watch?
It's not, no. the other one I watch is the Bachelor franchise. So
okay.
Yeah,
all
so
right.
I get on my podcast about that pretty much any time.
Is there, like, a girlfriend that convince you to watch that, or you just enjoy the theater?
I had girl roommates, and it was kind of a thing that we did. And it turned out that I really liked making jokes about The Bachelor and various properties, and I'm pretty good at making jokes about it. And then that turned into me sort of like taking it seriously is sort of the wrong word. But I watch it in the way that people watch – like guys you know might watch wrestling, you know?
Right. Like the theater. You enjoy the theater.
Yeah.
It's not a total joke, but you're laughing at it.
Yeah. There's some distance. You understand it's a show. You understand it's being totally manipulated, and you're sort of really watching to commentate on how they're pulling all that off as much as you are to actually watch the show, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a deep-seated hatred for The Bachelor or Bachelor or anything like that. I feel like if there weren't already 10 podcasts talking about it, like I'm mildly intrigued enough that I would watch it so that we could make jokes about it on the podcast.
Yeah.
Like that's about where I'm at. So,
I am the sort of person that watches it and roots futilely for a black person to ever win or be the Bachelor. Like I will keep pushing that rock up the hill until we get there.
First of all, good luck. Second of all, what is the average? I mean, how many people start on these shows? Like, how many bachelors started chasing after What's-Her-Face?
Yeah, I would say anywhere from, like, 24 to 32, depending
on average. So it's not the same number every time?
No. They'll change it up. And, in fact, not that long ago, they had two bachelorettes and, like, kind of, like, voted one off the island on the first episode. Which I thought was,
they like started with all the dudes and two women.
And they made the guys, they made the guys pick.
Vote one out?
Yeah, they made the guys pick as to which one they would be.
Oh, God, that is a horrible way of, like, the patriarchy taking over even the one place that women can decide something in our culture. But what was I going to ask? Oh, yeah, what's the average non-white head count out of that? Like, what would you say the percentage minority race is on one of these shows?
I'd say they've taken enough heat now that typically they try. Usually you get like three, maybe four. And I would say one of those is in that sort of like, well, I'm not exactly sure what this person is.
He's got an olive skin.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, there's one of those from San Francisco on this current season.
Of course he's from
a firefighter from San Francisco.
I did indeterminate hear someone talking origin. About that they have a firefighter on and they did a firefighting competition.
Yeah, yep, yep. That happened.
Which is amazing.
Seems a little unfair, doesn't it?
Sure does.
And somehow they got it down to the end where it was the firefighter, some other guy, and a radio DJ whose gear weighed like more than he did and had already passed out once in the challenge. So I was like, yeah, I think they pretty much set it up to be between the two dudes there, you know.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it was great. And that's the kind of stuff that makes the show kind of hilarious. You know,
sure.
I can't. It's really hard for me to imagine people who like watch it and take it really seriously. But you know, I guess slowly but surely, you do find yourself going, "Well, you know, I guess we know who's got it." You know, you find yourself handicapping the thing, and then I guess you see how people get caught up in it.
Yeah, I'm not. I think that last jump is the difficult one to make.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. By the way, Aaron Rodgers' brother is the I would say the odds-on favorite.
Really?
In this particular season.
I bet he's a looker. I mean, I'm sure he's a nice gentleman. Yeah,
he's kind of a looker. Aaron Murray's brother also. If you remember Aaron Murray, quarterback of Georgia? I believe he's like the backup on the Chiefs. His brother.
Wait, Aaron Murray's in the NFL?
Yes. Yeah, he is. At least the last I heard he was. I don't think he's thrown a pass in a regular season.
Oh, yeah, look at that. He's in a battle to be the Kansas City Chiefs backup QB with Tyler Bray.
Yeah, there you go.
Another blast from college past.
So his older brother, who I guess also played briefly at Georgia, was the winner.
His older brother.
A couple seasons ago, yeah.
Wow.
So there you go.
All right. Cool, I guess.
I guess if your brother's a football player, you have a big advantage.
Or if you're a football player, wasn't Jesse Palmer on that?
Well, he was the Bachelor, so he didn't actually have to compete. You know what I mean?
Oh, right. Good point. Okay. Yeah. That is different.
I can't believe we've spent this much time talking about this. All right.
Yeah. Well, were we done with the governor's ball? We kind of.
I guess that sort of thing ran its course. That gives you some extent of like the governor's ball was fun. If I can put a bow on it, but ultimately pretty disposable. Yes, they did. You were refunded. Obviously, if you just bought a day three ticket, which is a thing, you're refunded, and they gave a prorated discount to everyone who got 3 days. So, they lost their shirts on that thing, I'm going to guess, because I'm pretty sure you still got to pay Kanye whether Kanye plays or not.
I would imagine Kanye, especially given that he likes to talk about being in debt $40 million, I think he probably makes good on most contracts.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I think this is also great. An industry insider told me that Kanye had approval over the lineup, the poster, and all of the festival T-shirts.
The entire festival lineup?
Yes, that's correct.
That is insane.
I love it to death. It's so Kanye and so baller all at the same time.
It is the most Kanye boss move of Kanye boss moves.
Yep. So that was my trip.
And also, like, honestly, what does he care who's the first of 47 artists on Friday when he's playing Sunday? It's so that's amazing. Yep. That's just amazing.
Well, I doubt he was like combing through the lineup going, I don't know about this Christine and the Queens, but. I'm sure if there was something he didn't like, they probably heard about it before the thing went up.
I'm sure they heard about it.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. So I enjoyed my trip to New York, and I really enjoyed, like, everyone in New York. Everything in New York was exactly as you think it would be. Like, when you're in Manhattan, you see the people that you think are in Manhattan. Like, they're just so obviously New Yorkers. You know what I mean?
Tall, blonde women and, like, squat, thick-necked.
Yeah, like, lots of, hey, I'm walking over here. You know what I mean? Like kind of that thing. Not just, you know, not just those guys, though. Like, lots of different types of people. That's part of
not
what you expect.
Guys.
Yeah. Not just used guys, but the used guys were there. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, you're like, oh, yeah, that was what I was thinking. And then you go to Brooklyn, and it's, like, just exactly the kind of people you think it's in Brooklyn. It was really refreshing that way.
And yet somehow New Yorkers will tell you that they're the most worldly people in the world without actually going anywhere else.
Yeah. I know. Well, if you live in New York, the island literally is the world.
Yeah, well, shame on those people and shame on the city.
It's like, do you remember that old New Yorker poster, right, where it was like, New York and L.A., and off in the distance you could, like, see the Eiffel Tower, and that was pretty much the world.
Totally. Yeah, and they don't even really think L.A. is real.
Yeah. You know, it's literally like a giant movie set.
City, and then there's that Hollywood thing over across there, and then, like, there's some stuff in Europe, I'm pretty sure.
Pretty sure.
That's
where we came from, was the Europe.
And I am disgusted by it.
Really?
Well, disgusted's a strong word. I think they should own the fact that they're actually not worldly at all, but, like, some of the most insular, like,
they should definitely own that.
Narrow-minded bunch of – anyway.
Yeah. Before you get in trouble, maybe we should pivot to Muhammad Ali. How about that? That'll probably take us right back to New York in a second.
Get me in trouble, but let's do it.
All right. So Ali passed. Did you know, look, to me, there's not a lot to say about the man himself that hasn't already been said, and I have no quarrel, you know, with the notion of him as, you know, just a world-changing athlete, the greatest boxer of all time, a cultural icon. Like I have no quibble with any of that. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not inspiring to hear me retell it. Did you have something that you wanted to add?
I have just one thing on that, on a slightly personal note. One of my in a life filled with foggy memories, one of the clearest memories I have is of going to see the movie When We Were Kings with my father. And for those who don't know, it was a documentary about the Rumble in the Jungle, which was an older Muhammad Ali taking on George Foreman in Zaire. And it was a big deal socially that they were having this fight in Zaire. It was a big deal from a fight perspective as an aging Muhammad Ali took on George Foreman, who, I mean, I don't know how many people remember slash realize what George Foreman was like when he was young and fighting Muhammad Ali. And he was a big, cut up, scary fighter who had some of the maybe the best one punch knockout power in the history of boxing. You know, Mike Tyson probably, but Foreman was a beast who didn't like to talk much and traveled with giant Dobermans and just was scary. And Muhammad Ali, people were worried he was going to get killed. He was aging at this point, and that's the famous fight where he did the rope-a-dope. He basically took Foreman's punches into his arms for however many rounds, I think like 8 or 9, and then when people thought he was basically done as a boxer, let Foreman punch himself out, and then just took him apart in the last couple rounds. But the documentary is just incredible and tells the so much about what Muhammad Ali was as a social figure, as an athlete, as an American icon. And, you know, it came out in 1996 and it was like kicking around art house theaters, basically. And at 15 in high school, my father was like, we got to see this, and took me to see it. And having my dad, who as a kid was going to closed circuit movie theaters to watch Ali fights, watching that with him and having him tell me stories about watching Ali and about what it was like. I mean, it's a seminal experience in my life. And a couple years later, when I got to college, I would purchase a like 4-DVD set of Ali's greatest fights. And me and my roommate would just like come home probably at least once every 3 weekends and watch Ali fights again. And like, man, there's just nothing like it. And it's not hard to understand why the heavyweight division has struggled for most of the time since Ali retired. And there was a resurgence with Tyson, but the heavyweight division has never really been the same since Muhammad Ali, because no one could possibly give you the kind of excitement he did all across the board, whether it was in setting up the fight, in promoting the fight, and then in fighting. And so for someone who didn't actually live during any of his actual fights, his fighting did touch me in a weird way, and he'll be missed.
Yeah. I mean, look, I do think that Tyson, at least for a certain generation, simulated that sort of feeling. And, you know,
he just never had the foil. He never had those big opponents where he actually seemed challenged by the opponent. And Ali had these, trios of fights where people actually weren't sure. I mean, every Tyson fight he went into, you knew he was going to whoop ass until he was shockingly knocked out.
Right. You know, even that fight you went into knowing that he was going to whip ass, we were just wrong.
Yeah. And so much so that after the fight, people weren't sure what happened.
Yeah, I remember watching that fight. That was one that stayed with me forever. To me, the social part of Muhammad Ali is a little bit more interesting. And I find myself thinking about George W. Bush, actually, of all people. He was such... I know. Bush, I think, was a guy that recognized... that people of a certain stature at some point are really judged by the sweep of history and time, and that you kind of just have to do what you do, and hope that the record in the end plays itself out. Now, unfortunately for W, I think that is true and is going to probably not go well for him.
It won't go worse than it did when he was in office.
Yeah, well, maybe. You're right. Maybe it won't.
I don't know how it could.
I don't know. The record is not looking good at this point. But history may ultimately judge him more favorably, depending
on
what
happens.
I'm not
saying more favorably. I'm saying he was judged pretty horribly while he was there.
Yeah. And that's fine. And sometimes people are like that. And then in retrospect, you go, maybe it wasn't so bad, right? And Ali, I think, is a perfect example of that kind of athlete, and certainly that kind of social personality. I mean, right in the moment, his stance on Vietnam was incredibly unpopular and controversial and driven by venom.
And in retrospect, it's this brave thing.
Right, totally. It's this brave moment of consciousness that is celebrated by a president. And in fact, there was one, conservative congressman who was, kind of shot his mouth off about that particular part of the Ali legend, and just people have been ripping him apart for days. You know what I mean?
I believe he called him a draft dodger, right?
I think he just said his decline in the military service was a black cloud, and then everyone kind of, Twitter jumped him from there.
I think what resonates the most about that particular social issue is the way he talked about it. I think he really convinces you when you watch that little speech. He really convinces you that this is a simple issue. And it's about the fact that I do not support this war. I have no quarrel with these people. And I'm not sure why we're there. Which, at the time, a lot of people were still in a mode of, well, if the American government says this is the thing to do, that's the thing to do. And that's just not how the world works anymore. And I think Muhammad Ali plays a part in that.
Yeah.
Plays a part in citizens of this country questioning the motives of the government, which is now, pretty de rigueur.
Yeah. Maybe we've gone a little too far on that end of things. But, yes. And it does sort of you do find with Ali that there is this nostalgia for the athlete who speaks his mind, right? Like now there's a lot of people who are like, well, today's athlete is so safe. And it's interesting because I feel like, wanting athletes to speak their mind is one of those things that we say we want until we actually do it, and then we sort of rip them apart for doing so. What I mean? We want LeBron to be frank until he is. Is generally the way I think of it. You know what I mean?
I think that's generally true. And maybe this is just my own overconfidence that's about to speak, but I feel like I look at it in a slightly more sophisticated eye than that. And for me, I don't necessarily feel like athletes should have to talk, should have to express social opinions or political opinions. Matter of fact, I think I'm uninterested in hearing the opinions of most athletes on most things. That said, and I don't know if this has become a theme of the podcast yet, but it's certainly a theme of my life. I am infuriated by overrated things and by things that purport to be something they are not. And I cherish and celebrate underrated things and things that are understated about who or what they are or are doing. So when athletes act as though they've accomplished something for social good or for speaking their mind, when in fact they are not, I find that very troubling and somewhat infuriating.
Hmm.
You know, I don't need you to speak up on social issues, but if you're not going to speak up on social issues and you're not going to be a part of the conversation, then don't expect a pat on the back for some small nod to whatever.
So, is there something particular that you're referring to? Because I may feel differently.
I a little bit have this Derek Jeter thing in mind because we talked about it.
So if you're like, all right, so just to put a concrete example on it, because I think we'll get to Jeter here in a second.
Okay.
If, you know, LeBron wearing an I Can't Breathe sweatshirt or the Cavaliers doing that, like, to me, that's a thing that got some notice and I think is impactful, at least.
No, I think that's a good thing. And yeah. I think that's an educate. I think that came from a place of knowledge and education and of here is one way we can. I right now have a framed poster picture on my wall of a painting of the
The 2008 Miami Heat. No,
not exactly. I should just send it to you, but basically, it's three people. It is LeBron with the I Can't Breathe warm-up shirt. It is – I forget what the football thing is. It's a Rams player who – I can't remember what it was that he did. But there was like a thing where three things happened really close to each other. It was LeBron and company with the I Can't Breathe. It was the Browns wide receiver who had the Justice for Tamir Rice and John Crawford.
Was it like hands up, don't shoot or something like
yes,
that?
Yes, and yeah. Then the Rams guy was hands up, don't shoot. And it's like a painting of the three of them sort of rendered together. Like, I'm into sports figures taking small stands.
Yeah, God, I didn't expect you to go there with that. So is your problem – not that that's bad. You surprised me with the painting.
I went to an event where it was about – it was a bunch of sort of pieces of art involving sports figures sort of getting involved in more serious stuff. The other two I have up at the moment are a Jimmy Valvano one that sort of has his quote rendered out artistically, and then a poster of the Israeli contingent from Munich.
So is your problem with Jeter just that he doesn't say anything, or that he's wanting a pat on the back for something?
It's that he's wanting a pat on the back, and it's that he – okay, so the Players Tribune as a concept – inflames me.
Okay.
Because what Derek Jeter implies by creating and propagating the Players Tribune is that the media, this amorphous, you know, thing, the blob that the media has become, the specter of the media,
okay,
has been holding him back from sharing his real and true opinions and takes. And that Now that we have the Players Tribune, we can really speak our minds. When in fact, Derek Jeter's decision not to speak his mind is probably at least partially the fact that there's not much on his mind, and mostly the fact that he was playing for money, and he wanted to be marketable, and he wanted to be in ads, and he wanted to appeal to as many people as possible. As Michael Jordan famously said, Republicans buy shoes too. The problem is Derek Jeter would never say Republicans buy shoes too, because even that would be too controversial. He's going to say, hey, buy my shoes. And if your attitude has always been and will always be, hey, buy my shoes, don't try to sell to the world, now I'm finally giving athletes a chance to speak their mind. Athletes have had a chance to speak their mind. And even if there are some media people who would not handle it well, there have always been socially conscious, able to relate media people who are more than willing to tell the true stories and share the real opinions of athletes. And especially now, with Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all this, athletes are more than free to share whatever parts of them they want to. Sometimes too many parts, whenever they want, by a number of different channels. And so the idea by Gier of creating this thing where, like, finally we can speak to the fans, it's a bunch of crap, and it's just another play for money, by the way. And then for him to publish something about Muhammad Ali, which is 145 words long and not at all thoughtful, and frankly, it was a tweet of an article, and where he makes a point of saying he gave athletes the right to speak out and influence so many to be strong agents of change, to like put this thing out where he celebrates the idea of speaking. Again, to me, it implies, and I am following in his legacy with my Players Tribune. And in my mind, my response is, eat it, you fake gift basket giving piece of crap.
Okay.
I just because he never did that. And it's not, it's because he deliberately chose not to for financial gain. So to act like he's a part of this legacy, it's offensive.
Okay. I'm going to take a deep breath here. You've put me in a very awkward position.
Sorry.
Because I would like to be the captain of the team I hate Derek Jeter. Like, if that could be a thing.
And that's the thing. I don't hate Derek Jeter as a baseball player. I think he's a little overrated.
I sports hate him. You know what I mean? I don't. I have no hate for Derek Jeter, the human being. I've always enjoyed rooting against him.
Sure.
I think for a lot of the same reasons. I do find him to be incredibly bland. I do find his game, while undeniably great, to be vastly overcelebrated.
I mean, look, he's A-Rod, except with much better PR and not quite as good at baseball.
I would agree with everything you have just said, but I'm with Derek Jeter on this. I suspect that he probably never did have that much to say, and I think maybe the Players Tribune is, and certainly this tribute is evidence of that, and that's okay. But I do think that you are, and certainly the guy in the New York Daily News who wrote the column, but I think expresses at least somewhat of a similar sentiment.
It's similar, yeah. His name is Ebenezer Samuel.
Yeah. I hated that column.
Hated it.
Yeah, hate really hated it.
Why?
I think it's so just, and this is a guy who doesn't like Jeter, from a sports standpoint. I don't know the guy. Sure. And I think that that's part of it, because to me, most of what you have said about Jeter as persona and playing career and how it's offensive to you and how he's all about making money. And to me, all of that is motive that you have ascribed to Derek Jeter.
Hold on. Quote, he freed us all in that way. That's about Muhammad Ali.
Right.
He freed us all?
Sure. Derek Jeter had the opportunity to speak his mind and didn't take it. And to me, like, that's – look, would I prefer that he had – it was an interesting person with an interesting personality and interesting viewpoints who said controversial things? Sure. That would be my preference. But I hate the idea to sit here and stand in judgment of Derek Jeter without even vaguely being able to walk in the shoes of the man. That I find to be a bit odious. And I would like to proffer maybe another explanation for Derek Jeter, who certainly, I think we can agree, was as covered and scrutinize an athlete as you will ever find. That maybe Derek Jeter valued in some way his privacy, and that he felt that the best way to protect that and to avoid the squabbles and the just fray of day-to-day garbage that the baseball media and particularly the New York media would want to engage in, that A-Rod was so often caught up with, that the best path for him to do that for his life was to just kind of shut up and not say much.
That's
and
totally
to me,
fine.
So, that's so a reasonable position to take. And I just don't – I hate the idea of telling some other guy how he should live. That I just really – that bothers me.
I think I'm being slightly miscast, and part of that is because I don't have that. Part of my reaction is very visceral, so I don't have a step by step.
I may be miscasting you, but I don't think I'm miscasting the Daily News piece.
No, you're not. You're not. And the Daily News piece goes a little far for me. I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. Everything you just said makes perfect sense to me. I don't feel like he should be compelled to do anything, but. Here's what I would have liked to read in the Players Tribune, given the way he lived his life and played his career. When you're in the public eye, as I was, and as Muhammad Ali was much, much, much bigger than me, so much larger you could barely see Derek Jeter written on the paper where Muhammad Ali is written. It is incredibly difficult. You have no privacy, and the choice to speak your mind steals from that privacy even further. Many folks, myself included, did not have the courage of our convictions to make stands on important social issues. And therein lies the greatness of Muhammad Ali. I would have loved to hear something like that.
Sure.
Because if you're not going to write a thoughtful piece, then just tweet out, "The greatest has passed." Hashtag RIP Ali.
Yeah, look, I'm not defending the Players Tribune piece. It was
okay, but that's my point.
It was hackneyed. It was cliched. It was all the it was as generic as what we've seen from Derek Jeter. Like
it's what we've always seen from Derek Jeter, and that is what upsets me. Not the fact that he chose not to share his political opinions, but the fact that he seems to think he is doing.
I don't necessarily think that that's true. That's what I kind of mean by your ascribing motive. I don't think there's anything wrong with starting the Players Tribune and wanting to give athletes a way to talk to fans without the distortion of those comments, you know, in the media. Like that's a fine aim. And yes, even if that's more possible.
Not more possible than
it was before. I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with Derek Jeter embarking on a post playing career money making adventure. Good for him.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Money making venture that by its nature insults what I do. So I like that is why my reaction is visceral and angry.
But it's not insulting what you do. It's insulting the collective body of you and your peers, which includes the Baylesses and the Cowherds and the Whitlocks, just like it includes the Poznanskis and the, you know, whatever. Like it's the whole it's not you. It's the whole body of media. I mean, just how, you know, you're in sports talk radio, and I think you are certainly able to realize that there are a ton of douchebags with a ton of douchebag hot takes all spewed on sports media and the internet, maybe more than there ever was. So you know,
of course there is, but you
and that's
have
the thing, by the way. Was Ali more famous and more sort of world known than Derek Jeter? Yes, but did Ali have to deal with the kind of news cycle, 24-hour a day sports media garbage that Derek Jeter did? No. So
actually, you know what? I'm not sure I agree with that. I mean, obviously, Twitter didn't exist. The 24-hour news cycle wasn't
the internet
same,
didn't exist when Muhammad Ali was a conscious person.
That's true.
ESPN barely existed.
But Derek, all of his moves, every decision he made, every action he took, everything he said was covered 100% to the wall, and even if it took,
but 100% to the wall coverage in Muhammad Ali's day,
I would imagine
meant a very different thing.
I'm
not trying to argue, you know, Jeter had it worse than Muhammad Ali necessarily.
Muhammad Ali's life was every bit as disturbed and affected by media coverage.
Sure,
as Derek,
but I'm just saying that I think maybe the difference in the environment is not as great as you were kind of making it out to be.
I think it is. And by the way, by the time Twitter was really in full force, Derek Jeter was already a legend. Derek Jeter never did.
Right, which
did,
made him which you made you him to, right you, which made him ripe for shots, many of which I took. So I don't know that that makes it any better for Derek Jeter.
Yeah, but Derek Jeter never sees the shots you take. That's just not
he doesn't see the shots that I take, but I guarantee you Derek Jeter as a human being sees the shots. Look, I just believe in general, absent Derek Jeter or you know, talking about anybody, Hollywood, anyone who's famous, I believe that fame is not only a corrosive force in an individual's life, that it's more corrosive and corruptive than it has ever been. Now, if there's a difference, you know, maybe Muhammad Ali was at the very top of the fame pyramid in the 60s and Derek Jeter's just on a high rung. And if you want to say that somehow makes up that gap, fine. But, you know, I'll put it this way. If we had the kind of media environment that we do today, when Ali was one of the very most famous people in the world, I think it might have ripped him apart. So I'm not going to fault anyone for abstaining or wanting to find a way to try to deal with that gracefully. And I'm not going to fault them for whatever solution that they come up with, even if that's not the solution that I would hope that they would take. You know what I mean? Because it's just an impossible situation.
I agree with everything you've said. I just see Jeter as asking for a pat on the back for doing things.
Yeah,
he never
did. I just didn't get that. I thought it was a lame salute to a guy who was one of his heroes, and I just don't think it goes any further than that. If you want to go, look at Derek Jeter, still doesn't have anything interesting to say. I'm all with that. But
that's certainly true.
And I can't subscribe any notion of him being evil beyond that.
It's not evil. It's reckless and it's irresponsible. And even in the in the celebration of the man who perhaps in all his great sports achievements, perhaps his greatest achievements were social issues, to be just as lame and say just as little, it was to me. And then to like specifically say he freed us all. I mean.
I want to back up for a second. I want to take it out of Derek Jeter and kind of come back to this
idea.
Yeah,
forget that's enough Derek Jeter talk.
Do we really want athletes to be honest? Let me just hypothetically, you know, because Steph is on the record otherwise as saying otherwise. So I'm not trying to say that this is how he really feels. But let's just say
we're going to the North Carolina thing.
Yeah, let's just say hypothetically that Steph Curry, as you know, a heavily Christian, Southern raised African American male, it wouldn't be beyond the pale that his true feeling about the North Carolina bathroom law was hell yeah, I'm all for that. Would you want him to speak his mind in that case?
Would it make me like him more?
Yeah.
Would I want him to speak his mind if he is educated and has of a particular mind about a social issue? In theory, yes, I would.
Okay, so yeah, let's just say hypothetically, Steph argued in an intelligent fashion for the North Carolina bathroom law.
Well, I don't believe there is an intelligent argument for the North Carolina bathroom.
All right, let's say it was you know, intelligent and surprising. You know what I mean?
Then I would applaud him. Okay, and frankly,
I don't think you would.
I would not applaud his stance, but if it was a well-reasoned somehow – but again, it's a bad example because I don't think – for me, God said so is not a well-reasoned thing.
Right. And I agree with that.
And I don't think there's any other – I don't think but there even is another
I guess,
argument.
I guess my point is this. I guess
the North Carolina bathroom law. One is ew. And the other one is God says so, and neither of those are very compelling to me. So
my point is this: like, to me,
can I give you a better example quickly?
Okay,
let's say, and Steph Curry may not be the best example, but let's just use him. Let's say Steph Curry was a staunch Republican.
Sure. Also within the realm of possibility,
of course. And his reasons for being a staunch Republican were because he was a particular sort of fiscal conservative. And he, you know, whatever, a couple of like issues on which he had well thought out opinions.
That opposed yours.
That opposed mine.
Okay.
And he shared those opinions. Again, I don't know that I would literally applaud him, but philosophically, I would applaud that he was thinking about these things and cared about them and had a thought. And I think...
Well, do you applaud Curt Schilling for that?
I think Curt Schilling, yeah, in a way, yes. I think Curt Schilling stands out as someone who has thought about these things and has opinions. Now, he also makes thoughtless comments and says dumb things.
He's really into sharing thoughtless comments as much as anything else.
And like, that's where I will crush him. And I would rather someone stay silent than speak out thoughtlessly. But, you know, I mean, part of the problem in having this discussion is my general feeling is that most thoughtful people end up with progressive conclusions.
I guess, right. I mean, ultimately, you're more likely to think someone is more thoughtful if they agree with you. Aren't you? Aren't you?
Yeah, probably. But I'm not closed off to thoughtful people who disagree with me.
But there's a bit of a confirmation bias there. And I just look, I just can't. I'm not going to fault Steph. Or any other athlete, you know, and I kind of just hypothetically drug Steph into this, who just goes, I don't want to deal with that. And I think in your mind, that's about, I want to sell sneakers. And I think in my mind, it's a little bit more about, well, why do I want to deal with that? Well, I'm trying to win basketball games.
It's both, and I completely agree with you. If you want to focus on winning basketball games, focus on winning basketball games. But don't then slip something in and try to pretend a thoughtless thing is thoughtful.
Yeah, sure.
Don't then purport to be someone who speaks on issues, but only speak, you know, in half thoughts. And you know what I mean? Like, it's just don't be something you're not.
Yeah.
And don't say you're something you're not.
I just look at someone like LeBron, who I think is generally thoughtful about whatever he's talking about, whether I agree with it or not.
And you didn't think the I can't breathe thing was an important statement?
No, I thought that was a nice bonus, and I did think it was impactful,
yeah.
And I'm happy he made it. But again, he had a conclusion that I agreed with, so that helped.
No, but he picked something that he was passionate about, and that was important to him socially.
And I don't...
And he knew what was going on, and he was educated, and he made an educated statement.
I guess my point is that everything that he's going to say is endlessly picked apart in an embrace debate society, and I would never fault it to the point where it can fatigue us, and I would never fault anyone for wanting to sidestep to that, or you know, just giving Stephen A. just wanted to give Stephen A. and Skip less to chew on.
Well, I agree with everything you just said. I don't disagree with that at all. But I think seeing Jeter in that light and not pointing out some of the stuff he has written and chosen to do, I think that's only telling half the story.
Yeah.
I don't think Jeter is just a guy who chose that path and stuck with it.
Well, but
he's
I think
a guy who chose that path and wants people to believe he's more than he is.
Yeah, but see, I can't get there from that. I don't know that Jeter consciously wants us to believe anything. I think Derek Jeter just wants to live Derek Jeter's life,
maybe.
Which seems to be pretty damn fun if you're Derek Jeter. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with all that, and maybe you're right. Maybe I am over-assigning motives or whatever that aren't there. But
he seems like a pretty
simple guy,
don't you think? Operating on some pretty simple motives.
Maybe, but I see him wanting to be seen as more, and that bothers me.
Yeah. All right. Well, maybe I'm not willing to go there. And I think on that point, we'll disagree. So let's get the hell out of here. Do you want to assign any homework for the week? It sounds like
I still want you to watch Preacher.
Okay. It sounds like When We Were Kings would be a good thing for people to watch.
Oh, I mean, if people – yes, I you're absolutely right. Have you seen that?
No.
Oh, well, then in that case, if you can get to it by next week, you know, I think unfortunately we'll sort of run we'll get too far away from the story if you don't do it soon. But if you can watch it, I would love to talk about it. I think it's – I'm not a big documentary guy, as I think I said. And I think it's the best documentary I've ever seen. Part of that is the subject matter is fascinating to me, but it's also just incredibly well made. I mean, I think it got – anywhere you see it written about, it got tremendous reviews. I think it won an award or two.
Yeah, no, it's one of those movies that I had wanted to see when it came out, and I just didn't get to. So,
yeah. So if you can squeeze that in by next week, I'd love to. You know.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a crazy time.
5 minutes celebrating it.
With the, you know, I've been doing a lot of shows. Went to another one last night. I may get to another one tonight. And you got the NBA Finals and the Copa America.
Oh, wait, what did you?
Saw The Cure last night.
How great were they?
No, they're very good.
Okay. Part of this might be expectation management because I had no expectations, and they exceeded them by a lot. I don't see a lot of big rock shows, you know, and by big I mean really popular acts because they're expensive and I mostly don't care. I just thought they really were good. They sounded good. Robert Smith's voice is the same, I thought, and very impressive. And they kind of rocked in a way I wasn't totally expecting.
All right. I'm right with you on sounded good. That's the part of that. Like, yeah, the band is tight. Smith's voice has largely held up. Although, if you notice, he eschews some of the high notes.
Sounded just, I thought.
Yeah, the sound of the band is certainly the star of the show.
What was disappointing?
Well, I think the problem for me is that there's such a static stage presence. And if you're going to play for 3 hours.
Yeah.
And like, you know, look, I get some of that as fan service. Some of that is fan service. You know what I mean? They delved in some parts of the catalog that are not really for me.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, the pacing of the show I thought was a little tough. And I just no concession to entertaining me. I think he said 20 words and, you know, I stayed through.
Really?
I stayed through the whole first set and the first encore. I guess he did four.
Yeah, they did a lot of encores. I saw them at Shoreline. He was a little more talkative than that at Shoreline.
Yeah, I mean, just
a ton more.
Just gave us nothing. And
I hear that.
You can't do a 3-hour show that's just, hey, here are our songs. And you know, not it, literally enough. the video, and was it, I'm guessing it was like this for your show as well, was completely static, right? No camera changes, just two shots of the sides of the stage with people of wandering in and out of them. No close-ups, nothing.
Oh, no, that was not at all what it was like.
Yeah,
The video at Shoreline was completely different. They had close-ups. They had a huge wall of lights and video behind them.
We had a wall of lights and video, but the lights changed, but when it was video, the video never moved.
Oh, no, the video definitely moved on ours. And, I was on the lawn at Shoreline, and the video of the band changed, and we had close-ups of different of each of the members, and so that part was definitely different.
Yeah.
But they were relatively static. I mean, the most movement on stage was the bassist walking over the guitar.
He kind of wanders around sometimes. Yeah,
yeah,
I just wanted a little more show.
I went in as a guy, and I don't know if your approach was different, but I went in as a guy who probably would have known most, if not all, of the songs on The Cure's greatest hits. And like a couple other Cure songs, and like thought of them as a pretty good 80s band, but didn't think of them at all much beyond that. And I went with a buddy who was a much bigger Cure fan, and I left being like, that was really good. They're a real, you know, major rock band that just put on a major rock show, and they sounded great. So I think much of the stuff you said is true. I just maybe had lower expectations.
Maybe. I would have preferred less than the Springsteen length set, I think, from The Cure. That's just my take on it.
Well, I'm used to long concerts, so maybe I just take that in stride more easily.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. So I've been doing a lot of shows. I'm going to try to get to some more TV so we have some more crap to talk about.
What are your next two shows? Sorry, because we got distracted by The Cure. I'm interested in all the shows you're seeing.
God, what are the next two shows?
You said today and tomorrow, right?
I think I'm going to go to a show tonight, and I kind of don't want to say.
Because it's embarrassing.
Yeah, it's a little embarrassing.
Okay, now you have to say.
I'm going to go see Macklemore.
That's not that embarrassing.
It's kind of embarrassing. But I'm going to go.
Do you feel like I hope this isn't too inappropriate of a question. Do you feel like your shame is – like racial shame?
No. Okay. Here's my take.
It's not like you're losing Black credibility by going to a Macklemore.
No, it's not that at all. And here's my sole take on Macklemore and Ryan Lewis is that I actually think Ryan Lewis is really, really good.
Totally agree. And I think Macklemore has his moments.
Yeah, sure. I think Macklemore can do some stuff. I think Ryan Lewis makes really interesting beats. And I sort of enjoyed them.
Musical music.
Yeah. And my embarrassment just comes from the fact that, he's painfully uncool. It's just so uncool. So
he's the whitest white rapper since Vanilla Ice.
Yeah. So, but I'll go for, 30 minutes and check out some songs and probably hear a few that I enjoy and then go back and watch Warriors. That's my plan.
That's actually sounds like a pretty delightful night. I don't think you should be embarrassed.
All right. I'm a little embarrassed.
All right. So what's tomorrow?
And then there's a show on Friday, and I'm completely blanking on what it is. Did I tell you I saw Chappelle last week? I've been running around.
No, but that's great. I love Chappelle. And since we got distracted by Kanye and then Derek Jeter, what was the best thing you saw at the Governor's Ball? I mean, it was a music festival, right? What stood out?
I really enjoyed Beck's set.
Oh, I love Beck.
Beck did kind of one of those career spanner sets, Played Loser, actually, which I didn't see coming.
That's awesome. For 10 years, Beck was at the top of my list of artists I desperately want to see live and can probably afford to see live but have not seen live. And I saw him maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago at a festival in Monterey. And he's awesome, man. He totally delivered. And I really had, Beck envy because I took a semester off of college to play in a band, and Beck came to my college during that semester that I wasn't there. And so it was a big deal for me that I probably over dramatized, and he met every expectation I had.
All right. The other takeaway from Governor's Ball is that everybody's got a Prince cover now.
Yeah.
Beck included. And it was kind of fun, actually.
Beck already had Prince covers.
You could actually kind of figure out which cover song they were going to do by just based on the band and their style, which was kind of neat. So
that is kind of cool. You know what? I don't begrudge people that, man. Prince made music that anyone can play.
Yeah. No, I don't. It's fine. I'm not against it. Play Prince covers. Who doesn't enjoy a Prince cover?
Right? Exactly.
All right. So that's the move. Let's wrap it up on that for this week because I actually have to go do my real job now.
Yeah. Okay. Me too. So watch When We Were Kings, and you watch Preacher because we got two episodes, and I think we'll have three by the time we record again. And if you can at least get through one, I think we can have an interesting chat about it.
All right, yeah, I'm gonna try to on demand that. This gets into why, I'm gonna have watched 4 hours of Bachelorette this week by the end of this thing, and that's not a good use of my time.
That's trouble.
And I'm throwing podcast on top of that. So,
I understand you're a busy man,
Yes, but I will at some point reprioritize away from the Bachelorette and Macklemore. I swear to you all, people.
Maybe tonight when the Warriors game ends, you just sneak in a little Preacher.
Sure. We'll see what we can do. Here's the problem is that, when you have company, you don't always have the full range of your TV, I mean?
I know. Thank God I never have company these days. Wait, what? No, I mean, what?
Yeah.
Well, sad and alone.
All right, we'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.